Services of New York, Inc. Mr. Silver, good morning to you. Let's give everybody a second to get in and out of places here. And with that in mind, I think that's largely been accomplished, so you may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Jeffrey Silver on behalf of the plaintiff's appellants, Your Honor. We're here today asking the Court to reverse the District Court's order dismissing this case on a motion to dismiss. There are two bases for our position. One, there was sufficient minimum contacts to satisfy the Nebraska long-arm statute to provide jurisdiction to the District Court. The second reason, separately from that first reason, there was a forum selection clause in a reinsurance participation agreement, and in that forum selection clause it provided that the exclusive forum for any disputes surrounding that particular document would be the state of Nebraska or Nebraska courts. This case involves a client and a defendant who does business in 22 states, has approximately $18 million of annual payroll. Extrapolating that out on a conservative basis would put that at about $85 or $90 million of annual sales.
Is there any evidence that the defendant does business in Nebraska?
It does not do business in Nebraska, Your Honor. But it does business in 22 states surrounding principally New York and on the East Coast. And in 2014, the defendant reached out to Nebraska seeking workers' compensation insurance for its business in those 22 states. In reaching out to Nebraska, it was going to establish a continuous business relationship with the state of Nebraska and the plaintiffs in this case to provide workers' compensation insurance for its 22 state coverage. Let
Did
me be
they
clear.
Reach out to Nebraska, or was there a third party involved in a sort of middle person?
Well, there was a broker involved, Your Honor, that was brokering the workers' compensation request for the defendants.
Does that
defendants.
Make any difference to our analysis?
I don't think so. I don't think so, because I don't think you can insulate yourself from the jurisdiction of Nebraska by having a broker involved. And in this case, the broker was involved in the very, very beginning of the situation. The application was sent to Nebraska, and once the broker was finished with sending that application, all of the relationships between the plaintiffs and the defendant were direct and not through the broker.
Counsel, who actually signed the contract? Who are the two parties to the contract?
The two parties to the contract would be Applied Underwriters Captive Risk Assurance Company, Inc., I'll call it ACRA for short, and the defendant.
Okay. What is the relationship to ACRA, if I'm saying that correctly?
Yes.
To your client? What's that relationship?
The relationship Applied Risk Services under the Reinsurance Participation Agreement, Paragraph 8, has been designated as the billing agent for both ACRA as well as the defendants. So that is why that was named as the plaintiff in this case.
So your client's the billing agent named in a contract?
Yes, sir.
But your client did not contract directly with SEB, correct?
To the extent only one of, if you're talking about Applied Risk Services, that's the billing agent. There's a separate plaintiff, Applied Underwriters, Inc., which had a direct relationship with the defendant via a promissory note.
Okay, but on the actual contract, does that make any difference to our analysis that your client did not directly contract with SEB?
That's correct. It was not a signatory to the contract.
Right, but what effect, if any, does that have on this case?
I think none. I think none. That doesn't... I'm sorry.
We're really looking at whether or not Nebraska has jurisdiction over the defendant.
That's correct.
And I would like you to address the provisions of this clause that was a waiver of jurisdiction and which permitted the defendant to be sued in Nebraska.
Yes, I think my answer...
The district court found that wasn't valid because it wasn't truly signed?
Well, that's problematic for us, Your Honor, because what the district court did was essentially weigh the evidence. We had an affidavit put into evidence from the plaintiffs that indicated that the reinsurance participation agreement had in fact been signed.
I beg your pardon, those affidavits were received at the hearing?
Yes. The only thing that the court considered were affidavits submitted by both parties.
But this remained a motion to dismiss?
It was only a motion to dismiss.
Not converted to a motion for summary judgment?
It was not converted to a motion for summary judgment, Your Honor.
You have no evidence evidence outside the pleadings was taken?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Were the affidavits received by the court solely for purposes of the challenge to personal jurisdiction?
It was received for not only the issue of jurisdiction, but there was also a motion to dismiss based on failure to state a cause of action.
Did the court's order specify the purpose for which those exhibits were received?
It did not, Your Honor. It did not. It just simply recited what the evidence was in those affidavits and then made its decision based on that fact. And I want to make a point clear, if I can, because I know counsel is going to talk about it. This case does not involve workers' compensation claims. This involves a collateral agreement to that, because all of the workers' compensation claims that arose under this case were all adjusted and adjudicated in the various states in which those claims occurred.
Who signed the promissory note?
I'm sorry?
Who signed the promissory note?
Mr. DeNazzi, on behalf of the defendant.
And that was made payable to who?
Applied Underwriters, Inc., which is one of the plaintiffs in this case.
Counsel, there were some averments in those affidavits that suggest that the promissory note has been paid in full. Is there still a live case or controversy with respect to the claim going to the breach of the promissory note?
The chronology of what happened with respect to the promissory note, Your Honor, is at the time that the lawsuit was filed.
Is there still a live case or controversy?
Yes, yes.
And has the note been paid?
Yes, subsequent to the filing of the lawsuit. But at the time that the lawsuit was filed, the note was still due and owing and required to be paid.
The fact that it has now been paid, does it render that cause of action moot?
I think not, Your Honor, because I think the time to look at whether or not jurisdiction exists is to take a snapshot of what the facts and circumstances were at the time the lawsuit was filed.
Isn't mootness something that you look at periodically throughout the case?
It is.
Not just a snapshot at the beginning. Can't a case become moot while it's pending?
I think there's a difference between the case becoming moot because of the payment and the question of jurisdiction determined at the time the lawsuit's filed. I understand that the case itself may become moot as a result of the payment of this promissory note subsequent to the filing of the lawsuit. But that mootness does not relate back to the time that the lawsuit was filed when there was a live promissory note that was due and owing.
If the case is still lively, so to speak, what outcome would that provide to you?
I'm sorry.
If you pursue the case, what would you get out of it?
Well, at the end of the day, the fact that the loss that promissory notice has now been paid, we would remove Applied Underwriters, Inc. as a plaintiff. But you would still remain, the other plaintiff would still remain in the lawsuit because there's an amount due and owing separate and apart
so
from what's owing under the promissory.
So you would still have a plaintiff with a claim.
Yes, yes, Your Honor.
You have the $752,000 claim, hasn't you?
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you.
The court found that this jurisdictional waiver was disavowed before it was signed by SEB.
Right. That is also problematic for the plaintiffs, Your Honor, because again, we put evidence in that said that the reinsurance participation agreement, which contained the waiver and the form selection clause, was in fact executed before Mr. DeNazzi disavowed it. So we have a case, Your Honor, where the court was essentially weighing the evidence with countervailing affidavits and not giving us the benefit of the facts which under the case law we should have received.
So once they've signed that agreement, they can't take it back?
Yes.
Is that?
And I think that becomes a question for a defense to the merits of the lawsuit.
Isn't that your stronger argument for jurisdiction, is that the parties agreed that this would be, that they would be subject to jurisdiction in Nebraska?
I think so. And I can reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal if I can.
You may. Thank you very much. Mr. Bruckner, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, Chief Justice Evigan, members of the court. My name is Stephen Bruckner, and I represent the appellees in this case, SEB Services of New York and 20th Century Services of New York. Your Honors, there are numerous factual and legal flaws in the appellant's personal jurisdiction analysis. The appellants have utterly failed to meet their burden, and it is their burden, to establish that SEB services and 20th Century services have sufficient minimum contacts with this state to establish personal jurisdiction.
Well, what's the effect of the consent to jurisdiction? Was that signed by SEB?
Your Honor, there are several reasons why the form selection clause are utterly invalid. There are two form selection clauses at issue. Justice Stacey referred to the promissory note. I'll address that second. With respect to the reinsurance of participation agreement, there are several reasons why the form selection clause is invalid, and the court found these. First point, neither party, neither appellant, is a party to the reinsurance participation agreement. Justice Castle, I believe, pointed out that the RPA was entered into by a captive insurance company, not Applied Underwriters and not Applied Risk Services. So there's simply no standing for either of these appellants to enforce
standing,
this.
Was standing one of the grounds on which the motion to dismiss was premised below?
No, the grounds on which the ruling was premised were several. First of all, that the agreement was unenforceable because it was not properly signed and sealed, as it was required to be signed and sealed under paragraph 20 of the reinsurance participation agreement. And that's a really important point here.
What's the seal mean? What, do you have to have a stamp on it?
You have to, it's certainly unusual in this day and age for agreements to have to be signed and sealed, but there's an express requirement in that agreement that it be signed and sealed with proper corporate seal.
And if it's not, does that affect the validity of it, or is that just a technical defect in the document?
It absolutely affects the validity of the agreement, and that's what the district court found. And on this point, there was no...
Why does it affect?
It's defective because an express provision of the agreement has not been met. The agreement never came into effect. It's absolutely invalid. Whether it was signed or not by SEB or by 20th Century means nothing until it's properly signed and sealed by the other party in this case, and it was not. There was no weighing of the evidence, by the way, as my colleague, Mr. Silver, asserted. The judge did not weigh the evidence. If you look very carefully at the evidence in this case, there is absolutely no denial, nothing, no denial at all by the appellants in this case as to when that agreement was signed. All they say is it was the agreement that was attached to the complaint was signed and sealed, but that was done after the appellees in this case, 20th Century and SEB, disavowed the contract. So the agreement is invalid. The second basis on
Counsel, earlier I heard you raise the standing issue as to Applied Risk.
Yes.
Did you raise that standing issue before the district court?
That issue was not raised before the district court, Your Honor. Other than we did point out in our papers with the district court that there was an improper party. We filed a 12B6 motion as well as a 12B2 personal jurisdiction motion on that basis that the proper parties were not before the court. We didn't exactly style that as a standing issue, to your point.
So. I thought you just said, though, that you did raise the issue of whether there's proper parties before the court.
We certainly did, and I want to be clear that we didn't use the word standing, but we certainly did raise with the district court the proper party issue, yes. The second basis on which the district court, Judge Pankinen, ruled on the form selection clause was with respect to its enforceability under Section 25414. In our state, as the court is aware, even if you have a form selection clause in a contract, there's another analysis that has to take place. And in this case, the court determined that in addition to the agreement being unenforceable, the Nebraska was not a reasonably convenient form for the trial of this case. And there's a lot of really good reason for that.
What were the court's findings with respect to that?
The court made detailed findings.
With respect to the convenience of the form?
Yes, and admittedly not as detailed as the findings were with respect to the personal jurisdiction analysis, but the...
Just recite for me the findings then, the findings of the court as they pertain to the convenience of the form.
The findings of the court as they pertain to the reasonably convenient finding is that these defendants do business in other states, not Nebraska, have never done any business in Nebraska. all of the witnesses and all of the documents are located in New York. The payments with respect to the reinsurance participation agreement were all withdrawn from the appellant or the appellee's bank accounts in New York.
Aren't you reciting the findings with respect to minimum contacts now?
No, I think the findings, as I said, were very much the same with respect to the reasonable convenience argument. And on that point, it's very, very important. I believe the court clearly found that it's not, there's no ability for the court in Nebraska to compel the attendance of witnesses, which would put SEB and 20th Century at a tremendous disadvantage.
In this
because
case, wouldn't the witnesses just be the parties to the contract?
Not
because it is a breach of contract and a breach of promissory note, would that be the parties?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. The key witness in this case was the third-party broker who was referred to earlier, and that does make a difference. There was no contact whatsoever by either SEB or by 20th Century of any kind with Nebraska prior to the time that this transaction was entered into, and there's no ability to compel the attendance of Marshall Corman, that third-party agent in Nebraska. It would put the appellees in this case at a complete disadvantage.
Can a district court issue a request to another court in a different state requesting that that court subpoena that person?
I'm sorry, someone was coughing, Your Honor, I didn't hear you.
Can't the courts of this state request that a court in another state subpoena particular person to appear as a witness?
I think it's very difficult to do that. There is no mandatory that I'm aware of, no compulsory process that could require Mr. Corman to be here. And if you're defending a case, you certainly have the right to defend it with the person's your choice.
Could the parties obtain a trial deposition?
They could obtain a deposition, Your Honor.
Right.
Yes.
Go to another state and file under whatever they do in that other state, a miscellaneous docket and notice it up.
They certainly could, but that is not what the case law talks about. The case law in this state, and there are many cases recited in our brief on this very point, are that you do weigh the reasonably convenient aspect of Section 25414 when you're evaluating the forum selection issue. And in this case, while the plaintiff's choice of forum is entitled to some weight, other courts, both federal and state, as we discuss in our brief, have found that Nebraska is not a convenient forum in an applied underwriter's case.
If this agreement were properly executed, do you think it could be enforceable?
If it were properly executed, it may be enforceable, although, Your Honor, as we point out in our brief, there's a very serious question across the country in several jurisdictions, California, Wisconsin, Vermont, perhaps others, about this entire workers' compensation scheme.
Are those legal opinions or are those administrative?
Those are administrative at this point. There are some lawsuits pending, but those are administrative.
What weight does that have with us?
I think a great deal, and I think it relates. To the issue of whether Nebraska is a reasonably convenient forum. Now, Mr. Silver pointed out that workers' compensation insurance isn't at issue, and respectfully, I disagree with that. Because if this case is adjudicated in a reasonably convenient forum, such as New York, New York law would almost certainly apply because New York has an interest in assuring that
does
employers and employees are protected by workers' comp.
Does reasonably convenient have to be convenient to both parties in the lawsuit or just one of them?
I think that the express language of the statute and the intent of the statute is that it be reasonably convenient to both parties. Case law does suggest that the plaintiff's choice is given some weight, but other cases involving applied underwriters, both in the Court of Appeals and in the federal trial court, the district court, have found that Nebraska is not reasonably convenient on facts almost identical
is
to the facts
of
we have.
Is choice of law a proposition relevant to personal jurisdiction?
Pardon me, Your Honor?
Choice of law a relevant consideration?
When you look at the case law, you do see that in those cases, the court will look at what law applies. And part of the reasoning with respect to the issue of the reasonably convenient prong under Section 25414 is, will you have a court in Nebraska trying to apply the law of another state?
We do encounter that. We try.
Certainly. I agree, Your Honor. That's certainly the case, and it's not that the courts here would be incapable of addressing New York law. It's just that state, a state that's a proper forum, would be the better choice, the more reasonably convenient forum. And I see that...
Before you sit down.
Thank you.
You've been talking about the reinsurance participation agreement, and I would like your impression about whether the nature of that agreement itself is significant to our analysis. It is not a typical insurance product. It's not a pay your premium and then you're done. It is more interactive than that. Is that right?
I agree, Your Honor.
Is the interactive nature of this particular insurance product and the fact that it was a 3-year contract that was entered into, are those significant pieces of information to our analysis?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe they are. The appellants in this case have chosen to sue on that particular contract, even though neither one of them are parties to that contract. When you're looking at strictly a personal jurisdiction analysis, both with respect to minimum contacts and, if you get to it, the form selection issue, which we have discussed during this oral argument. So the nature of the contract, I don't think, is all that relevant to the personal jurisdiction and form selection analysis. Thank you. We respectfully submit that the judgment of the district court should be affirmed. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
1 minute and 8 seconds.
1 minute and 8 seconds, Mr. Silver.
I have it, Your Honor. Thank you. Justice Stacey, I want to respond to your question about the analysis made by the district court on the issue of convenience. Here is the exact analysis. Secondly, even if the RPA was valid, the court finds the forum selection clause to be unenforceable because Nebraska is not a reasonably convenient place for trial. That's the extent of the court's analysis as to whether or not Nebraska was a reasonably convenient place for this court.
Is it an error of law to not provide further analysis under 25.413 and so forth?
Well, I know the court's reviewing it de novo. I don't know if it's an error of law because the court determined not to do an analysis. But let's be very honest, I think, here. Every time that you have a party have to defend itself in another jurisdiction, it's always inconvenient. And if that was the only measure by which we're going to measure things, a form selection clause would never be enforceable. In this particular case, the RPA was negotiated between the parties. It clearly and unequivocally provides in bold language that the exclusive forum for determining issues is going to be the state of Nebraska.
Counsel, what significance should we give to the other cases that your opposing counsel cited us to involving this insurer?
Absolutely, Your Honor, and I lost every one of those, so I know about it. But if you look at those, the issue of jurisdiction is very fact-specific. And if you look at those cases, all of those cases involve defendants who were single-state, relatively small employers. This is a case where you have 22-state employer, a large employer with a significant amount of payroll, significant operations. So, and frankly, I should have appealed to the Nadari case, and I did. I think it's bad law, and perhaps you could take care of that in your opinion in this case. May I be excused?
You may be excused. Thank you very much. Our next case of the day is Anderson.